Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Malo ni kum na Māori bon dia and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Eggy Dubow, and coming up on the show, in Fiji, the government has tabled a bill to repeal free access to the country's surfing waves. There's a group of settlers who made their home in Port Moresby after fleeing violence in the troubled Indonesian region of Papua, only to now be evicted, leaving many homeless. And American Samoa's women's soccer team have won their first ever World Cup match. Those stories and more, but before we start, let's give acknowledgement that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Me taki ma'ata. Thank you. From our team here at Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We start in Fiji, where the government has tabled a bill to repeal free access to the country's surfing waves. The Commercial Use of Marine Areas Bill was tabled yesterday with the aim of returning ownership of marine resources, including surfing waves, back to the customary Itauke people. Tourism Minister Bill Gavoka told Parliament that the new bill will restore an imbalance and make things fairer for the country's citizens.
It addresses a long-standing legal and governance gap impacting the rights of customary owners, the integrity of our marine resource management, and the certainty needed for sustainable commercial use of Fiji's valuable marine areas. Mr. Speaker, sir, for too long now, Fiji has operated under fragmented and outdated arrangements governing marine areas. One such law being the Regulation of Surfing Areas Act of 2010, the Act. This Act aims to promote Fiji as a surf destination through unrestricted access to surfing areas for tourism and recreation. Mr. Speaker, sir, while this Act allows tourists, hotels and businesses to use these areas freely without exclusivity, it expressly provides that any person can use a surfing area without any payment or any compensation to any person. It has contributed to growth in tourism, but it has also socio-economically impacted customary owners who previously received compensation for the use of the traditional Ngoli-Ngoli areas. This has resulted in A, unclear propriety authority over certain marine spaces, 2, misalignment between customary ownership and commercial use, and 3, tension across tourism businesses, tourists, and customary groups. Mr. Speaker, sir, the delay in clarifying this legal position has allowed disputes, grievances, and incredible benefit sharing to continue. Therefore, this bill will provide long overdue legislative clarity by recognizing customary property rights in a manner that is consistent with natural justice, constitutional principles, and modern governance standards, and introducing a fairer, more equitable benefit sharing framework. Mr. Speaker, sir, overall, this motion is important, given the impact of this law to the tourism sector. Since we announced the review of the Regulation of Surfing Area Acts 2 years ago, there has been ambiguity on what there is to expect. The Speaker said it will therefore give the tourism industry a definitive timeline in which this law will take effect. Mr. Speaker, the Commercial Use of Marine Areas, or CUMA Bill, seeks to repeal the Registration of Surfing Areas Act of 2010, and replace it with a new, fair, and transparent framework that reverts proprietary ownership of marine areas used for commercial purposes to customary owners. So the bill provides for a reverse and process which will be in line with the rule of law and principles of natural justice with all parties actively involved. It also empowers existing indigenous institutions to play a central role in administering and overseeing these marine areas.
And that was Bill Gavoka's Fiji's tourism minister speaking in Parliament during the first reading of the Commercial Use of Marine Areas Bill, which will only come into law once it passes a third reading and is then signed off by the President. But one person backing the new bill is Fijian surfing pioneer Ian Vravovo Muller. Mr. Muller says the 2010 surfing decree removed exclusive ownership of waves and beaches from resorts and private owners, making Fiji's waves accessible to local and overseas surfers. But he told the ABC's Girish Sawani that the time is right to repeal the decree so that the traditional owners, the Itauke people, can manage their own resources.
It was actually a sense of relief that this is something that has been needed for quite some time. People have forgotten those dark days. They've easily forgotten about the dark days of how exclusivity was such a hard time for us as local surfers, the industry to grow. And now I see that, you know, through the surf law that we work hard to create, and that sort of opened the door for surfers from around the world to come and enjoy our waves. So I see that this is, it's actually something that's in the process of how we are going to go through to manage these world-class resources from a traditional standpoint and perspective, which as I think is critical, because we, the resource owners, the people, we know what's best for our country. And I think the repeal is something that's timely, and it needs to be done, because we lost our way when we got exclusivity. And now we need to restore justice back to the people and to the true resource owners that have used these areas for centuries.
You are on record saying that, you know, you felt like a second-class citizen when, you know, there was exclusivity to resorts that had access to those amazing breaks. How was it for you like at that point? And now that things might change, what benefits would there be for the local indigenous owners of the coastlines?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a very sad time for us to be treated in that way. Not many people, there were not many of us local surfers, so not many people understood what we were going through, the pain, the heartache, the humiliation. So it's very easy for a lot of people to talk because they weren't there. We experienced it, and it was something that I do not want to ever experience again, especially being a Fijian in my own country. So I feel This is a very positive way moving forward for our people to grow. Since we've opened the waves in 2010, 15 years ago, it's created a lot of opportunities for local businesses and, you know, not just locals, but foreign businesses. So everybody's flourished. And I feel that there needs to be some form of management before we destroy this world-class resource. And we've seen it happen all over the world. This is going to give people, especially the resource owners, more management of their traditional resources, to give them guardianship and give them opportunities and give them skill sets so that they can feel proud to look after what is really theirs, nobody else's. And nobody should really be talking against what these people, their requests and what they intend to do, because it's theirs.
Yes, and would there be an impact, you know, on surfing businesses, the businesses you said that have boomed, you know, since things opened up? So would there be an impact on those businesses and also for tourism, specifically surfing tourism in Fiji?
I think it'll be, there'll always be an impact in some form of tourism. Tourism has an impact regardless, an environmental one, an impact on our culture, our people. So we're trying to minimize that, and we're trying to keep it sustainable. At the moment, that the way we're going, it's not going to be sustainable. And these resources will be destroyed, and foreigners will leave, and we, the people, will have to clean up the mess. So we need to be smart the way we move forward and protect it now for a sustainable future so that these investors can also get a return of their investment. And everybody wins. So creating some form of management structure, like an ocean park, where it's a user pay fee, it always surprises me that people tend to not want to give back to nature. And they pay for man-made structures, but nature is really where we need to protect, because nature is going to be a commodity in the future. And that's going to be, have more value than anything man-made.
Yes, and are you confident that, that these new laws, when they come into being, we don't know the details of it. Are you confident that they will be well-governed, that the money will go to where it's needed, and that in the words of the tourism minister, Bill Govoka, that no one will be overcharged?
I think that we need to be given a chance. It's something that's a new age for Fiji, and it's exciting, and we need to embrace this. And I think we need to empower ourselves, and we need to learn from the rest of the world, and not let it happen here in Fiji, and make it better, and create a model in a local sense, creating something that can be for the rest of the world to aspire to. I think Fiji has a really good opportunity here. And we have a world-class resource that we need to protect, restore. And just like any other national park of any sort, there is, if people want to go and enjoy it, you have to pay. And that money goes back to village goodwill, restoration of the reef, protection, security, lifeguards. So it becomes, if you want to come back in another 5-10 years' time, the resource is still the same, if not better. That's what we want to aspire to.
And that there is Ian Ravovo-Mula, pioneer Fiji surfer and supporter for the new bill repealing free access to Fiji's surfing waves. And he was speaking to ABC's Girish Sawani.
Talo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Raiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific. Culture Compass, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Malo Dalmai Bombongini, welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head to Papua New Guinea now, where around 200 people of West Papuan heritage are calling for help after they were evicted from the Red Hills Gerihu area in the capital, Port Moresby. The families say they were given permission to live there by Port Moresby governor back in 2011, but the National Court has rejected this claim, ruling that the land belongs to agricultural company Swanita Limited. Arnold Omda, a spokesperson for the group, says the settlers made their home on the land after fleeing violence in the troubled Indonesian region of Papua. Mr. Omda says police arrived on Thursday evening before evicting them the following day. He told the ABC's Godwin Eke that 16 homes were dismantled, with many families now homeless.
Yesterday, the police commander, Gerihu police commander, the area we live, 5:30, they just come and make the awareness with the loud teller that said that the eviction will be come up on Friday. They didn't present the court order to evict us from the area.
So you weren't given any written notice or warning before the eviction took place?
Yes, the Friday morning we went back to the police station, but then we didn't get through the police station commander. So when they came to the make the eviction in the area, they didn't present the eviction order. They just come and by full force and come and make a demolition for our house. Family, almost 16 houses with the family, the 16 householders with the family. The damages, all the things, gardens, whatever, the plate, pool, cup, or the available something, they break it to all them.
Anul, how long had you and your family been living in this location?
In 2011, under West Papua Refugee Relief Association, the technical officer of the association. We have a chairman. 2013, we got the planning approval to develop in that area.
And Anul, what belongings or property did you lose during the evictions? I know you said there's about 16 homes or 16 families that's been affected by this eviction.
Yes, we built a semi-permanent house. Some lot is a small house. And then, we have a power connected to the area. We connecting power from the PNG power, and then water, and then fridge, house.
What was your main source of income before the eviction, and how has it changed since then, since the eviction?
That's our, most of our community, we just... To sustain our life, we just make a small garden, greens to sell. And then that particular gardens, right now I'm already damaged. So we don't have a stable income now.
How has this eviction affected your children's education or school attendance being disrupted?
For myself, I have four children, that three children in the school, but right now they didn't go to the school. I'm applied to others' family too. Around the area, they didn't go to the school.
Are you facing any new financial challenges as a result of relocation or since the eviction?
We feel that now our family just sleep outside on the open space without shelter, and we just feel that traumatic and feel that uncomfortable for us.
What support, if any, have you received from local authorities, NGOs, churches, or the West Papuan community in Port Moresby? Have you received any support?
Right now, we don't receive any support from the charity organization. Just yesterday, from the CBC Catholic Bishop Conference, they came here to get the information to observe the situation on site. They get just only CBC. We appeal to the government of Papua New Guinea to help us, especially for a piece of land so we can settle properly. Secondly, we look for just situation where we are, we need support from food or shelter for us. Right now, we don't have anything. Belongs to us, it's already choice, so we need help.
And that was the spokesperson of West Papua Community living in Red Hills in Port Moresby, Arnold Omda, speaking to reporter Godwin Eke.
Hold the front page!
Malo Lili, and welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie DuBois. I am joined in the studio this morning by producer Carl Evans, who's bringing us our headlines from around the region. How are you doing this morning?
Oh, I'm getting a bit over these sub 20 degree days in Melbourne, to be honest, Aggie. It's, aren't we entitled to something a little bit better in
December?
It's
a little bit bipolar with the weather at the moment, isn't it? One minute it's sunny, but it's windy.
I know. Only in Melbourne can you get 30 degrees and 15 in the 1 week.
Yeah, goodness. Okay, well, obviously to the Pacific, there is a lot happening. This first story, unfortunately, it's about the Pacific's growing HIV problem. It's appeared to have hit the Solomon Islands now.
That's right, Aggie. 34 new cases of HIV have been recorded in the country this year, marking a significant increase from the 8 cases recorded in 2024. Mm. So the Minister for Health and Medical Services delivered the grim news during his address to mark World AIDS Day, saying that 34 new cases now brings the overall total to 79 in the country.
Wow.
And he also said of the 34, 25 are male, and what's worse, 27 have succumbed to what's called advanced HIV and the complications that come with that, meaning basically they've had the virus
for a
long time without being treated. So he just reinforced to the public to go out and get tested, especially if you are unsure. Because once treatment begins, you can enjoy a long life. But I think what often happens, Aggie, it's a bit of a vicious cycle. You know, the fear of thinking of people thinking they might have it almost prevents them from getting tested. Almost out of fear of receiving a positive result. So
yeah. Well, please go and get tested if you are listening in this morning. We head to Air New Zealand, though. Their workers in the Rarotonga have 2,000 cabin crew in a carrier-wide strike. What's happening here?
Yeah, so cabin crew in Rarotonga have raised their own concerns over changes to working conditions and employment agreements, which they say is a breach of their Employment Act. So among the issues they've raised with Air New Zealand include the removal of guaranteed rest breaks. They get no 10-hour breaks. break between shifts, apparently. They get called on their rostered days off.
Oh, wow.
And in some cases, they don't even get paid properly, you know, with things like penalties and overtime and things like that. They also claim that contracts gives their employer discretion to change the terms without them realizing. And it just creates a lot of, you know, confusion and coercion for the workers, and just this overall feeling like they have no, I guess, power or rights.
Mm.
And what's worse is because they are not unionized like their counterparts in New Zealand, they just have so much less power, essentially, and they don't get treated as well. So luckily, a lawyer in the Cook Islands has picked up their case and is pursuing a collective employment agreement pro bono.
Right.
To try and improve their conditions. And given this is all coming as more than 1,000 cabin crew across Air New Zealand's international and domestic fleets get ready to go on strike on the 8th of December, what better time than now than to strike while the iron's hot? But hope you don't have any flights booked home to New Zealand, Aggie, that time.
I mean, well, you think about it, no rest breaks, no 10-hour, do you know what I mean? It does sound a little bit off and not being paid properly. So, yeah, let's hope that gets sorted. We head to sport now. Vanuatu's national soccer team, they recently won the Melanesian Spearhead Group Prime Minister's Cup. They've been rewarded with Christmas party funds. Oh, what does that mean?
It's great. It's a great story, actually. Very, very generous indeed. So the Vanuatu government has decided to divert the funds usually reserved for government Christmas parties to its all-conquering national soccer team.
Right.
So their men's team, they were given a hero's welcome after they dethroned Papua New Guinea 5-4 in a penalty shootout in the final of the MSG Prime Minister's Cup. And now the Daily Post is reporting that they'll receive 10 million vatu, which will be distributed to the players, coaches and officials, with the players all getting about 200,000 vatu each, all from the government.
Wow.
The women aren't left out either. They'll also walk away with about 100,000 vatu each after they beat the Solomon Islands to secure the bronze medal. So yeah, happy days all around for the soccer team.
But I'm just wondering, okay, the money's going there, but does this mean the government workers won't get a Christmas party?
Yeah, it probably does. but the government has clarified that there will be end-of-year celebrations held through other initiatives, so I'm not sure exactly what that means. But look, they have gotten treated pretty well in recent days. The government actually gave all their civil servants permission to take a half day to welcome the national soccer team when they arrived home from PNG. And what's another great wrinkle of that as well is the ministry responsible for youth and sports has now been tasked with developing a new policy and a guide and a new reward system athletes who you know succeed in future events can get compensated when they get home. So
sounds like a win-win around for everybody.
Absolutely.
Wow, good Christmas for them definitely this year. But Kyle, as always, thank you so much for bringing us our news wrap here on Pacific Beat. Yes, so you would have heard those headlines. It is now time for a quick recap. We started in Fiji with a government tabled a bill to repeal free access to the country's surfing waves. Also, a group of settlers who made their home in Port Moresby after fleeing violence in the troubled Indonesian region of Papua have now been evicted, leaving many homeless. Still to come, though, as Papua celebrates its 64th anniversary of independence from the Dutch colonial rule. But when will they be independent from the rule of Indonesia? And American Samoa's women's soccer team have won their first ever World Cup match. Stay tuned for all of that shortly, but right now, let's talk West Papua. Now, West Papua's national flag, the Morning Star, was raised during ceremonies around the region yesterday to mark the 64th anniversary of the first time it was flown as a symbol of independence against what was then Dutch colonial rule. It is now a symbol of independence against Indonesian colonial rule and has flown around the world in solidarity with the West Papuan cause. At home, the Morning Star is banned but is still flown by defiant West Papuans. Joining us this morning is Australian-based West Papuan campaigner Ronnie Garini. With that, I say hello, Ronnie. Thanks for joining us on Pacific Beat.
Hello and good morning. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Ronnie, look, what are the emotions, you know, that go through your head every year on December the 1st?
Yeah, well, before we begin, I want to acknowledge the Morning Star, which you mentioned, that symbol of defiance. And for us yesterday, it's more than that. It's the mana. It's the life force that ties the Papuans and our ancestors and our land. And as 64 years now, It carries that whispers of promise made back in 1961, a promise still waiting to be fulfilled. So for me and many of our West Papuans, we celebrate that. It's celebrate that in pride and also that memory of suffering and pain of the 64 years. It's more than that as well. It's about the spirit, which the heartbeat of our identity, the breath of those who have walked before us. So it rises yesterday and it reminds us that even under colonization, under Indonesian brutal military operation, our soul cannot be conquered. So it's a drumbeat calling us to remember who we are and why we stand.
Wow. I mean, yes, if you could maybe elaborate a little bit more, describe, or like, where is the fight for independence from Indonesia? Like, where is it today?
Where it is today, it's best explained as it's the movement is like a river. Sometimes you see it clearly, sometimes it's hidden, sometimes it's high or low tide, but it's always flowing. And so the fight for independence is just like the river. Like in the highlands, the resistance is strong with the West Papua National Liberation Army against the Indonesian military operations, which has also impacted in terms of the displacement, increased thousands of displacement of women, children, and families. But then beyond that, in the streets, the civil resistance, and then out into the region and in the in global stage, it's more weaving the new threads, connecting our struggles, our stories, but clearly to human rights and climate justice. And as we would know, the island of New Guinea itself, between our, together with Papua New Guinea, the forest itself is comprised of the second largest in the world and contributing to the what is always known as the second largest lung of the world. And so here we are in terms of what it means today in terms of the independence movement. It continues to grow. Noting here that the youth are propelling the movement, and even on the 1st December across the western tip of the island in Sorong town, it was the youth-led movement that went down to the street, even in the central highlands in the town of Wamena, and then across to Jayapura. And so we are seeing that. So they are navigators, they're propelling, they're even engaging more in the cultural storytelling and as climate defenders. So we are seeing the new hope coming through with the youth, carry the manner of the voices of our ancestors into new spaces. And whether it's grassroots networks, global forums, social media, that movement isn't confined to just on the streets or in the jungle, but it's global, and the youth are its heartbeat.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, you know, around that sort of support, because we know the Pacific Islands, right, have traditionally been a stronghold of support for West Papuan independence. Do you then feel that that still remains the case today?
The grassroots solidarity across the Pacific, yes, still remains strong today. It's rooted in the shared history and the ocean kinship, the cultural manner, and when that kind of like also inspired, when I mentioned shared history, it's the movements like the Nuclear Free and Independent Pacific, whereby the civil society, the churches comes together. Even the formation of the Pacific Conferences of Churches back in the 60s, the West Papuan churches were affiliated or members in co-founding that. And so that history is rich. And then when we talk about the independent movement between the 70s onwards, the NFIP or Nuclear Free and Independent Pacific, West Papua were at the forefront of it as well with some of our elders. And so that tied very strong in terms of today, the grassroots solidarity. But when we look at it more in terms of intergovernmental spaces, which is the likes of the Melanesian, the sub-region grouping of Melanesian Spearhead Group or the Pacific Island Forum, this is where it becomes a bit more complicated with Jakarta's diplomacy through trade, defense, infrastructure has created what I call an economy of silence. And some governments soften their stance in exchange for economic ties. So while Pacific peoples march, as we see yesterday in Suva, in a few towns in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and in Vanuatu, Papua New Guinea, at the street, people march for freedom. Some leaders even negotiate for ports and patrol boats. But for the government of Vanuatu remains steadfast as well, and has been the beacon of hope and light for Papua, West Papua, and also within the Pacific. But when we talk about the intergovernmental spaces, that is where it becomes a bit tricky to really find ways to navigate through those corridors to bring the issue of West Papua. But the solidarity remains strong through the Pacific grassroots.
Yeah, Ronnie, I understand that just over a year ago, right, former General Prabowo Subianto was sworn in as Indonesia's president. Now, I know he's been accused of mass human rights violations in West Papua and East Timor during his time, right, as Special Forces Commander. So I'm wondering, what impact has his leadership had in West Papua?
Yeah, Prabowo's presidency since a year ago, as you highlighted, it feels like a return to an old script, one written in the ink of control and power. And over the past 12 months, he talks about development and autonomy, which continuing Jokowi's approach of developmentalism, but autonomy without justice is just co-optation. And this is one thing that we're seeing across in West Papua, where we're seeing military take on civilian roles again in providing greater security and safety for investment, foreign investments, like in the food project, in programs in the southern part in Merauke, and as well as other, like in parts of the north coast, like in Sorong with Nicole, and then the exploration and expedition of the other gas reserves for LNG projects. And so the military are pretty much taking those projects and providing those security. So those projects are being militarized, and then new battalions spreading across Papua under the banner of prosperity. It becomes a prison, a big prison that is not seen. And that is pretty much domination as well. So as we see, Jakarta's strategy is clear, particularly for the people of West Papua, where the fragmented provinces, flood with troops and mass control as autonomy. That's why for the people of West Papua, there is no hope in Indonesia, to be part of Indonesia. That's why the call for Merdeka or freedom remains unspoken, yet unbroken.
And, you know, you said things like the movement, it's like a river. You talk about economy of silence. So overall, Ronnie, what are your feelings for the future? Are you optimistic that West Papua will achieve independence?
For the people of West Papua, and including me, I am hopeful. Hope isn't naive. It's the fire that keeps us alive and keeps us moving forward. And while, I'm not blind, I know Jakarta uses co-optation in many ways, economic incentives, autonomy, programs without justice and the fragmentation, but seeing the young people, the youth of today, are propelling the movement, and even I'm in my early 40s, and knowing that the younger ones are inspiring me, and I'm inspiring my the elders to propel the movement, it shows that the future, it's going to be a long struggle still ahead. But yes, in terms of our identity and justice for freedom can't be erased, and that spirit is still alive. So looking ahead in terms of 2026 will be a year of more strategic advocacy on the legal, political, and the grassroots movement building with a focus on the climate justice and ensuring that the capability building of our youth leadership moving forward as well to continue to be the voice of our people.
Thank you for that, Ronnie. Look, that's all the time that we have for this morning, but thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing here on Pacific Beat.
Thank you for having me on the show on the Pacific Beat. Thank you, Aggie.
No worries. That, of course, is Australian-based West Papuan campaigner Ronnie Garini here on Pacific Beat. Now, back to Fiji. It's known for its warm hospitality, crystal clear waters, kava, and even a relaxed pace of life. But what about sheep? In the last decade, the country's national sheep flock has doubled, and the government is keen to capitalise on the boom. It's even got its own breed called Fiji Fantastic. The country's National Director of Animal Health and Production, Anavesh Dal Das, told Lucy Cooper the industry has been around.
Sheep was introduced in 1920s by early settlers. In that time, the numbers were around 8,800 sheep. But then in 1960s, the numbers fell down to 50. And that's where we had issues of, that we did not, there was not a right breed because they brought in the woolly breeds, and they could not survive in this hot tropical environment. And of course, we had issues of dog attacks and internal parasites. And of course, it was a new community that time, so the management systems and nutrition was not good. So that's why the numbers really fell from 8,800 to 50.
To help boost the sector, Fiji has its first locally bred sheep, Fiji Fantastic. What makes this breed different to, say, a classic Merino or a Dorper breed?
The difference is that they are a hair sheep, and so we don't have to shear them. It's easy to maintain them. It has got a very good reproductive rate, and it's got a lot of tolerance to disease, especially the internal parasites and foot rot. And then, of course, it exhibits very good growth rate, So that's why it's different to some of the other sheep.
What different breeds of sheep have gone in to create that singular breed?
It was the Black Belly Barbados, which was introduced first. And it, these particular Black Belly Barbados were crossed with three different breeds. The other three breeds are Corriedale, Wilshire, and Paul Dorset, which was imported from Australia.
And so since 2014, the number of sheep farms in Fiji has increased by 61%, and the national flock has doubled from 18,000 to 41,000. Has the Fiji Fantastic breed been behind this boom?
Yes, of course. Combined with the infrastructure and assistance that the government has been providing to actually help the farmers, especially providing sheep sheds, fencing materials, the much-needed infrastructure cost has been borne by the government. So that's why the interest has come from the farmers, because government is assisting a lot in that area.
Was there a targeted effort to create a breed like Fiji Fantastic in order to boost the sector?
Yes, it was. That's why it took us, I think, close to 20 years, 15, 20 years to come up with that breed. So we were looking at those attributes that we wanted really in a sheep that could help us grow the industry.
Given the Fiji Fantastic sheep breed is suited to tropical conditions, does it have the potential then to be exported to other Pacific islands or even somewhere like tropical North Queensland?
Definitely. We have, in that regards, we have already exported some to Tonga and Samoa, and they are now raising and developing the breed. And there's also a lot of requests from other countries like India, also for New Caledonia to look into the to this particular breed, Fiji Fantasy, because of its attributes.
I suppose when people think of Fiji, they're not really thinking of sheep. In the past decade to 20 years, say, how much more important has the sheep industry become to the economy?
I think we have been able to produce our own local mutton, and probably we have contributed to at least 2%, I think, towards the importation. Though the importation and the demand, because of demand, still remains high, you know, we still able to produce around 150 to 200 tons per year, compared to 88,000 tons that we are importing annually into Fiji.
And that's Fiji's National Director of Animal Health and Production, Avnish Dal Das.
What's your favourite view where you live in the Pacific? Grab your phone or your camera and take a pic of it, because Nija Daily is running a photo competition. We're looking for photos which represent you and your part of the Pacific. Anyone can enter, you don't have to be a professional, and there are prizes up for grabs. So get snapping and send us a photo in WhatsApp of your favourite view. It's +61 437 519 385. That's +61 437 519 385. And tune in to Nija Daily weekdays from 7 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia for all the details.
Whakawe lahi, thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat. Well, first there was the documentary, Next Goal Wins, and then the movie of the same name, both of which celebrated American Samoa's first ever win in a men's World Cup soccer match 14 years ago. Well, now Next Goal Wins 2.0 is being played out in Rarotonga, where American Samoa's women's team have won their first ever World Cup match. And very shortly, they'll be taking on the host nation, Cook Islands, in the hope of making it two wins out of two and going through to the second stage of Oceania World Cup qualifying for the first time ever.
When American Samoa took on Tonga in their opening match of the preliminary round tournament in the Cooks, they weren't just searching for a win, but a goal as well. So their frustration grew as chance after chance went begging, but then finally they grabbed one goal before half-time and two more in the second half to seal the deal.
Mafala and Summers runs onto it. Great work from the American Samoas. Here's a chance, and finally, they get it done. American Samoa lead 1-0. Drago again looks for another opportunity. Drago, it goes in. Second goal for Drago, and American Samoa extend their lead. It's 2-0. This is a chance, and it's three goals for American Samoa. And that's the full-time whistle, and American Samoa can celebrate here in the Cook Islands.
Double goal scorer Cassidy Drago was chosen as player of the match, but she was insistent that the win was a whole team effort.
I think we did everything well. I think we worked together so well. I think even when adversities came up, we all still were there for each other. Our team worked so well together, starting with our defense to our forwards. It took the whole team to be able to win this game. There's not one player that wasn't involved.
The American Samoan team is made up largely of heritage players recruited from the US college system. And so far, it's working for them and their coach, former United States international Amanda Cromwell.
There's so many emotions right now. You can feel the energy and the excitement with the team and just so meaningful for the country. The first half, the goal was slow coming, but keeping that 1-0 going in the half was huge for our mentality and our energy, and just so proud of this team and team behind the team. All the executives that are here, my staff has been amazing. So just very thankful.
Standing in American Samoa's way and some more soccer history are the host nation Cook Islands, who squeaked past Tahiti in their opener.
Hetherington takes it towards the side and now tries to send it through the middle. Kadur taps it away. Roro gets it down for Cook Islands. Finally, they break the deadlock.
1-0 the final score, and coach Rhys Rucker enjoyed the winning goal as much as anyone.
Yeah, pretty happy. When the goal went in, I got a little bit emotional, if I'm honest. The whole group and like the crowd looking up, I was like, wow, this is pretty special.
So the Cooks will have home advantage in their World Cup showdown with American Samoa, but based on the first two games, the visitors looked the sharper and must surely fancy their chances of going where no American Samoan soccer team has ever been before.
And that's Richard Ewart reporting there. And he will bring you news of the outcome of that important World Cup qualifying match in our PM edition of Pacific Beat at 5 past 5 PNG time this afternoon. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story, with the Fiji government tabling a bill with the aim of returning ownership of marine resources, including surfing waves, back to the customary Itaukei people.
This act aims to promote Fiji as a surf destination through unrestricted access to surfing areas for tourism and recreation. Mr. Speaker, sir, while these acts allow tourists, hotels and businesses to use these areas freely without exclusivity, it expressly provides that any person can use a surfing area without any payment or any compensation to any person.
And that was Tourism Minister Bill Gavoka. Now, we'll be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. And you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Up next, it is your news. And coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. So until next time, o tō awhātou. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.